Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And after the program, we keep the conversation going on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Plus, our new download service allows you to listen to any episode of Philosophy Talk anytime, anywhere. Learn more at philosophytalk.org.
Our topic today is math and the mind. Mathematics is great stuff. It allows us to express fundamental physical laws. It's used throughout science evolution. It's also used in daily activities, describing sports, planning our economy. It's all involved in technology. In the first segment, we're going to explore the power of math as a cognitive tool to help humans understand things.
And in our second segment, we'll ask what it is about the human brain that makes it so uniquely good at using and refining mathematics. All animals and some machines do math in one way or another. I mean, a hawk zeroing in on a mouse from way up in the sky, an ant navigating its way back to its colony, a computer working out the value of some function. They're all doing sophisticated mathematics.
But nothing else we know of in the universe does math in the same way that the human mind does. We've continually invented new forms of mathematical reasoning, and we found more and more domains to which we can apply math. What is it about our Stone Age brains that allows us to do all this?
Which leads to our final segment. Will understanding how the brain actually does mathematics help teach mathematics better?
Well, Ken, that's a great outline, but my philosophical mind has a little trouble with some of the things we've just said. I mean, suppose I kick a field goal, right? And the football describes this nice arc through the uprights, a perfect parabola, I would guess. Or I throw a rock, and the same thing is true. Does that rock and that football have to do math in order to follow the parabola? That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, the rock and the football, I agree with you, don't. But I think I'd say the ant and the hawk are really highly sophisticated mathematical calculators. Highly sophisticated mathematical calculators. But you know, I want to. There's something else. Galileo, one of the great founding fathers of the scientific revolution, said this: "Mathematics is the language with which God has written the universe." That was his way of saying that if you understand the universe in the way that in mathematical terms, you understand it the way God himself did. And if you don't understand it in mathematical terms, you don't understand it at all. That's powerful stuff.
Well, you know, with all due respect to Galileo, let's pause for a moment and see if that makes any sense at all. Here I am. I'm looking at the universe. What do I see? Equations and numbers. If he wrote a novel in English, when I looked at the novel, I would see English sentences. If he wrote the universe in math, when I look at the universe, I should see math. So I don't get it. How can this all be right? How can the human mind be so suited to do math, and so many human minds like mine be so poor at doing math?
Well, that's kind of a paradox. And the question is, does the fault lie with our brains? Some of our brains just aren't suited to math. Or does it lie with the way we teach math? I mean, if you think about language is easy. Why is math so hard if we're suited to math uniquely?
Our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, went out and talked to someone who's trying to find out the answer to that very question. She files this report.
I always thought I was good at math. But when Patrick Soupy started telling me about the mathematical proofs his fourth graders are doing, I admit, I needed a little help.
Would you mind working that out on the board?
X plus Y is greater than X plus Z, then Y is greater than Z. So it's so-called cancellation.
Right, so if you subtract X from both sides, it shouldn't be a problem.
All right. I mean, intuitively it's a lot, but proving it takes some machinery to prove it.
Soupy's runs the Palo Alto-based Education Program for Gifted Youth. The program uses computers to teach students in virtual classrooms. Soupy says that offers advantages a human teacher would have a hard time matching in a traditional classroom.
A very bright fourth grader should really be working at sixth grade level. But he or she has to sit there and do fourth grade material looking out the window. A student who's behind needs help in third grade material. That's a piece of cake for a computer, giving that very individualized attention.
Soupy's interactive computer program starts at a basic level.
Color the pentagons green, then click OK. Remember, pentagons have five sides.
and then advances based on how quickly students master the material. Supi says the main difference between what you might call math people and everyone else is speed, the ability to master more concepts in a shorter amount of time.
What's like the difference between a professional tennis player and an amateur? Professional football player and a pickup game in the park? Well, there's not some fundamental conceptual difference. It's in the refinement of the skills.
Supi's believes the top 3 to 5% of students are skilled enough to take calculus in the ninth grade. But he says all students can learn math, not just the most gifted.
We don't want the world full of professional mathematicians. What in the world do we do with them? Just like we don't want the world full of, 10 times as many professional tennis players as we have. Doesn't mean we don't want an educated populace who has some math skills, some math concepts and understanding.
In fact, Supi says our society increasingly demands mathematical thinking, even for people who don't work in finance or accounting.
We have a natural move toward numeracy. We have enormously complicated tax codes. Everywhere you turn, you have to be able to understand the use of numbers and the way our society, our extremely precise bureaucratic society, is organized.
And he says that doesn't just mean dealing with numbers per se.
One of the main topics in math is reasoning. But it's reasoning and general skills in reasoning that are needed for this kind of understanding of all these wonderfully, endlessly bureaucratic things that people have to face up to now. Even taking a driver's test has that kind of feeling to it. That's a broad sense of mathematics. The ability to reason systematically in a successful way would be a more general characterization of what mathematics helps train.
So if we accept the premise that everyone should know mathematics and add to it the axiom that everyone can learn mathematics, I think it follows that I have no excuse for not remembering trigonometry. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And today we're joined by Keith Devlin. He's professor of mathematics and a senior researcher at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. He's author of, among other things, The Math Instinct, Why You're a Mathematical Genius, along with Lobsters, Birds, Cats, and Dogs. And he's also the math guy on NPR's Weekend Edition. Keith, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Okay, thanks for the invitation. Nice to be here.
Keith, you're a mathematician, one of the most likable, friendly, and accessible mathematicians I've ever known, to tell you the truth. But most mathematicians I know spend most of their time thinking about mathematics, numbers, functions, big cardinals and things like that. Proving theorems, applying the results, maybe, something practical, writing a research grant occasionally. But you're interested in the mind. You're interested in cognition. You're interested in how the mind or the brain does math. How did you get to those topics?
Oh, well for a large part of my career, I did exactly what you described. I just proved theorems. I was an example of what Paul Erdős said, a mathematician is a machine for turning coffee into theorems. And then
that's great.
I guess I had a midlife crisis. I mean, an academic midlife crisis. And I suddenly began to sort of wonder what it was that I was doing. Like most mathematicians, I never reflected on what I was doing. I was just literally was a machine that was doing this stuff, and I got a lot of fun from doing it. I recognized the beauty. I liked rising to challenges and solving difficult problems, making discoveries, proving new theorems. But then I just started to reflect on it. And the more I reflected, the less I understood what it was that had basically paid my mortgage for many years and kept me off the streets in a reasonable lifestyle. So one of the questions that really puzzled me was this one, was, we've got a brain that evolved to do a whole bunch of things and was essentially in its present state long before mathematics came along a few thousand years ago. And so mathematics has to be a specialized use, an exaptation in Stephen Jay Gould's language, of existing mental capacities. And so I just started reflecting on a broad scale about the nature of this subject and how it relates to other forms of thinking.
Well, okay, so now let me go back to this quote from Galileo that you've mentioned and that Ken mentioned at the top of the show. Do you really think that God wrote the world in math, and do you really think that we haven't understood something until we've understood it in mathematical terms? That leaves me without understanding very much, except maybe batting averages in baseball.
I think in its own way, mathematics tells us more about the human mind than the world outside it, if that indeed makes any sense, because what we're doing in mathematics is we're giving a very precise description of the way the human mind, or the human mind body, if you want, encounters the world and sees the world. So it's a mathematics arises out of the interaction of human brains and the environment in which they find themselves.
I'm not quite sure I understand exactly what that means. Let's explore that a little further. I mean, the Galileo thought was that, you know, when God spoke the universe, he said, let F equal MA, let right. E equal MC squared, and that the reason we can use math, because he was living in a time when the Aristotelian scientists didn't use the language of mathematics for science, right? It was all in qualitative terms. And he said, look, God basically made the universe a bundle of quantities, and we use the mathematics to express that. Are you agreeing or disagreeing? I'm not quite sure.
So if we take Newton's law, forces, mass times acceleration, we know what happens if we take a table and push the table. But the table is something that we recognize. I mean, you know, whether you're a string theorist or whatever you think of as the substrate of the universe, that table really only exists because humans classify it. So when you say the table accelerates because you've applied this force, you're describing things that act and things that move and change, which are really products of human cognition.
So, I mean, there seems to be a little dilemma here. I mean, if math is the product of human cognition, then surely God didn't use it to create the world. So which is it? Is it a structure that's there before humans come that they've adapted to, or is it it's something due
well,
to humans?
It's certainly not something that we're arbitrarily creating, because it is, and the sense we have, those of us that do mathematics, is one of discovery. But when you really try to drill down into what it is you're talking about, you eventually reach this layer of things that humans recognize and things that humans categorize, because we're, you know, the Galileo thing, I mean, and that was a scientific revolution, because what Galileo said is we won't try to explain why things are or how they are. We'll just assign numbers to everything we can think of, and that very often means inventing things, like we invent something called temperature, because that gives us a number that we can assign to what we now call temperature. So we assign these numbers to categories we invent. And from then on, science consisted of just looking for mathematical relationships between those numbers. And it's proved incredibly successful.
So mathematical relationships between those numbers, and you said it's proved incredibly successful. I think I read in some work of yours that you think of mathematics as the science of patterns.
Right.
So mathematics, they're all the patterns. Yeah. I take it you think the patterns are really out there.
Yeah.
Our brains are designed to pick up on these patterns. And mathematics is a way that our brain has used to kind of express regularities, express these patterns and explain these patterns.
Right. And those patterns are there in the sense that the sound that the tree falling in the forest is. I mean, but when you really drill down again, and that's that same phrase I'm using again, the things you're really talking about are things that result from human categorization of the world.
So let me put my question a different way. I think when we send out these spaceships to far outer space with this project to find other intelligences, we assume, and we put a little math on the side of the spaceship, and we assume that that'll give them a clue into our way of thinking. So, would any rational beings anywhere in the universe, if they pushed hard enough, come up with exactly the same math we have?
That always amused me, because, I mean, I recognize thing, you know, the binary expansion of pi, but you just think about it. If these creatures discover a sophisticated spacecraft, aren't they going to realize that we must know some maths to have built that thing and sent it up in the first place? Why bother writing it on the outside? We couldn't have built that sucker if we didn't know about pi.
But are they going to know the same math? Are they going to pick up on the same patterns? Would any kind of rational, so that the math is somehow out there? But you know, we're going to have to take that question up after our break, because it's going to get into a complicated discussion. I think
it sure is.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're talking about math and the mind with our guest Keith Devlin from Stanford University, who's also NPR's math guy. By pressing down a special key, in place a little melody.
We're talking about math and the mind today on Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Keith Devlin from Stanford University.
Keith, I want to push a little harder on this idea that all these animals like lobsters are doing math. Now, I hope you'll agree that the rock and the football that I kick don't do math.
Right.
They just obey the laws of mathematics. Now, some people would say that an eagle falling out of the sky to hit to strike a mouse is also just following the laws of mathematics. There's just a lot more parameters involved that we don't understand. How do you draw the line between following the laws of mathematics and, in some sense, using and maybe even understanding the laws of mathematics?
Well, like all lines that have to be drawn, it turns out to be a very fuzzy line. But you've only got to look, it's really a matter of when we're prepared to describe a certain activity as doing mathematics. People have long ago given up the game of assuming that mathematics is uniquely human, because we talk about our pocket calculators doing mathematics. A good pocket calculator now would get a grade B or C on most high school exams. A good mathematics software system like Mathematica or Maple could pass most college-level math exams. And we happily talk about these calculators and these programs as doing mathematics, but they're just electronic devices. If they obey any laws at all, it's the laws of physics and the laws that govern the way electrons flow around circuits. And yet we happily describe that as doing mathematics because it suits our purposes as people and the way we use these machines to think about it as doing mathematics. So reflecting in this way, you realise that calling something doing mathematics is just a way of describing something that's useful to us. And so if we see an eagle doing some operation, or a hawk soaring, or an ant performing some operation, and it's clearly doing something that's very clever in its own terms and that's helping its own survival, then it seems to me entirely reasonable to call that doing mathematics.
I mean, I don't think you could actually explain how the hawk gets to the mouse from way up there without attributing at least some kind of inner capacities to track kind of significant mathematical regularities. It's not like the stone, which doesn't have to track the laws of physics. It's just subject to the laws of physics. But the hawk is doing something pretty powerful with its brain.
Yeah, and if you want to draw the line, I think you're homing in on it now, Ken. It really comes down to, is that creature or that entity doing something that favours its own purpose and making decisions? And if it's acting in a purposeful way, if it has some kind of intentionality, then I think it's quite reasonable to talk about it as doing mathematics. In fact, you've got to say the hawk is doing trigonometry. I don't know any other language to describe what it's doing.
Many animals and some machines can make quite sophisticated, if unconscious, mathematical calculations, but nothing else we know in the universe is quite so adept at mathematics as the human mind. Now, our guest has just said that we're all, he says that we're all mathematical genius. Is he right? Do you yourself feel like a mathematical genius or a mathematical dunce? How does your brain do mathematics?
Tell us what you think. The number is 4,158,414,134. For you that are math challenged, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
So, Keith, it seems to me, you say lots of things do math, right? But the human brain is kind of it doesn't do math in quite the same way that all these. I mean, it does some of that because just get around in space and time. But you seem to think our brain is built for doing kind of conscious, explicit mathematics in the way it's built for doing natural language.
Right.
First, is that analogy right? Is math to the brain something like language is to the brain?
Oh, I think it's more than that. I think mathematics is derivative on the fact that we have a language capacity.
Really? Tell me how that works.
Okay, and there's several reasons for that. One is it's just the unlikely. I mean, human beings is the only species with language, full language with grammar, able to recurse indefinitely and put things together in complicated ways.
Recurse, man, that sounds like a swear word. What do you mean by recurse?
It can just keep reflecting on itself and processing things in an iterative fashion. So the brain has this unique ability. The human brain is the only one that's able to do sophisticated offline thinking, planning about the future, thinking outside time. The human brain is the only thing that seems able to do this mathematics. Now, either we have three extremely unlikely occurrences all happening in one species, or language, offline thinking and planning, and mathematics are all different sides. This would be a three-sided coin. They're different sides of the same mental coin.
Between you and Ken, I've just had this brilliant idea that irritation is the beginnings of human language, because when something happens again and again that's irritating, you say, oh, darn, oh, darn, oh, darn, oh, darn, you're recursing. And you're also using recursion. It's all I can do to run out and write a paper about that right now.
Get joined in this conversation. Are you a mathematical genius? Do you feel like one? How does your brain do math? 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Dan in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dan.
Hi, thank you. So let's assume that we only know the tiniest bit of all the math that exists in the universe, all the theoretical or even practical mathematics. What are the implications of that, that there's all this math that we don't know? Are we doing it, or are we not capable of doing it?
Certainly on a personal level, we don't have to assume that, because there's already more mathematics that is known and written than any individual person can possibly know about, and that's been the case now for almost 200 years. But if you think of mathematics as the stuff that would fit our present description of mathematics, then it seems like potentially infinite. And it's simply a matter of just going on and discover. I must admit that, you know, despite everything I've said so far, I do have this feeling that, like all practicing mathematicians do, that mathematics is out there waiting to be discovered. When I'm doing mathematics, I'm an out-and-out Platonist. I think there are good evolutionary reasons as to why the brain has to approach mathematics that way, and maybe we'll get to that later. But I do have this feeling of discovery, and as all processes of discovery, we're always aware that there's more to discover, but we're not really aware of what we're missing until we've discovered it, because we haven't discovered it yet.
I mean, there's an interesting thing about mathematics. I mean, it's a highly progressive. I mean, some people talk about the progress of science and science being a progressive cumulative thing, and there are people who kind of would tend to deny that. Yeah. But for math, it's so obviously true that it's a progressive cumulative thing. We know about the natural numbers and then the rational numbers and then the reals and then the complex numbers and all this stuff, you know, and it just keeps building. And you can embed the earlier thing and the later thing.
Science is revolutionary, and it throws out the old and replaces it by the new repeatedly. But mathematics is evolutionary. It's a cumulative, additive process.
Well, now, suppose we take this mathematician's point of view that we're really doing discovery, and we kind of think of how the metaphysics that would go along with that, which is what a lot of people, back to Plato, up to Frege, have believed, that there's this universe of abstract object numbers that we have the ability to discover and grasp. But the problem there is, how could abstract objects interact with us through evolution and have any effect on the way our brain works? So how do you reconcile this feeling the mathematicians have and your idea that the ability to do math has to do with evolution?
You know, that's the darndest thing is, the one question I, and I think almost every other mathematician I've talked to, has found virtually impossible to answer is, you know, okay, they'll buy the whole story, but at the end of the day, there is what's been described as the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. This process whereby you lay down, close your eyes, and reflect on these abstractions produces thoughts that you can eventually apply in the world to kill millions of people or to make millions of dollars for thousands of people.
Well, there's another thing, and we've gotten a little bit off one of the things we really want to focus on. I want to go back to your analogy between math and language. It's more than an analogy.
Oh, yeah.
The mind is built for language. It can do math because it can do language. You know, language is easy. It's the easiest thing in the world. Just talk to a kid, and it's a language genius.
Yes.
But math is really hard. Talk to a kid in mathematics, and 95% of them aren't going to get to higher mathematics. Well, why is that?
Right, they're not going to get to high mathematics, but they are going to get to basic. There's actually two kinds of mathematics, and now I'm coming onto something that's not universally agreed. But to my mind, there are two kinds of mathematics that are often thought to be two variants of the same process, but they're not. There's abstracted mathematics, which comes from humans looking at the world and abstracting things from them, like circles, triangles, numbers, surfaces, and so forth. And then there's symbolic mathematics, which is linguistically created. And that second one is unnatural. The first one is natural. And there's actually a lot of field experimental work that's been done to demonstrate that everybody, except for a small number of people with a disability called dyscalculia, can master abstracted mathematics.
Okay. I want our callers to join us. 415-841-4134. Are you a mathematical genius at symbolic math, or sort of ordinary math that we're all good at? Tell us what you think. And we've got a caller on the line now. That's Stephanie in Kensington, California. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stephanie.
Hello.
What's your comment or question?
Well, I think it's partially been answered already. My comment was this. Early on in human development, children discover the mathematics of space. You know, there's an inside and outside. The ball is round. If I throw it hard enough, it'll bounce back from the wall, this sort of thing. And I would like your guest to tell us if that is the beginning of our understanding of abstract mathematics. And then later on, as we develop our natural language, say in English or whatever, we get a taste of the symbolic activity in mathematics. We never, unless you go far enough, you'll never have an understanding of, you know, what it is you're really doing unless you crack open something, a text on metamathematics. So I was wondering if that distinction between abstract and symbolic activities in mathematics is also where you would draw the line between, you know, the math that animals are able to do, but they just aren't far enough on the evolutionary scale to develop a facility with symbolic activities in math.
Stephanie, excellent question. Keith,
okay, let's be a little bit careful. I use the phrase abstracted mathematics, which is actually not abstract mathematics. It's mathematics which is abstracted from the world and is really about the world. And let me just tell you about one of the most dramatic pieces of research that was done back in the 1990s. Some researchers went out into a street market in Recife in Brazil, posing as shoppers. And they went up to young kids looking at market stalls, kids between 8 and 14 years old, and they presented these kids with very complicated purchasing problems, with tape recorders, hidden tape recorders working. Those kids did immensely complicated mental calculations and got them right with 98% accuracy despite all the noise and bustle in the street market. The researchers then came clean, met the parents, visited the kids in the quiet of their homes a few days later, and gave those kids a little written math test. The questions on that math test were the same mathematical problems the kids had just got correct with 98% accuracy, except it was written symbolically. The accuracy rate dropped to 34%.
Oh, wow.
The kids could do it in the environment in which the brain evolved to do stuff. They couldn't do it symbolically. The difficulty with mathematics isn't that we don't have mathematical brains. We don't have symbolic brains to the right degree.
That's a very profound result, and it's replicated in all kinds of things. It's not just little kids.
No,
doctors prescribing medication to their patients, and you give them the error rates and the success rates. You give them in symbolic notation, they screw it up.
It's the symbolic abstract stuff, and yet that's the great power of mathematics. It's the fact that over the last few hundred years we have developed this linguistically constructed symbolic mathematics. That's the powerful stuff. I personally think that that is not something that most people will get very good at. I think that's a very different kind of process.
415-841-4134. Give us a call or send us an email at comments@philosophytalk.org. I think you got an email there.
Yeah, we've got an interesting email. I asked two questions. This is Fred Griswold. What about music and math? Music is all math, isn't it? All except for the creativity. That's the first question. Second one relates to something we were talking about a while ago. Can plants do math? I mean, after all, Keith, you might need trigonometry to explain why a sunflower moves the way it does. But are you going to tell us that that the sunflower is doing math?
So what do you think, Keith?
So music, well, it's certainly the case that, mathematics is all about patterns and music is just certain kinds of patterns in time. And so, and indeed, historically, if you go back to the ancient Greeks and even much more recent than that, mathematics and music were always regarded as the same kind of thing. It tends to be a little bit overblown, and you get all of this nonsense talked about things called the Mozart effect, which is complete bogus. I don't think there's a huge connection between mathematics and music, although people tend to like the same kind of things. In terms of plants, yes, it is the case that we see things like the Fibonacci numbers and the golden ratio being exhibited in plant growth. What that tells us is that nature, because of the way evolution works, has homed in on very efficient solutions to problems of growth and survival, and mathematics is the ultimate tool for describing efficient maximization solutions.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing math and the mind with NPR's math guy. He's also Stanford's math guy. That's Keith Devlin.
If the human brain is built to do mathematics, why is math, especially higher math, so hard to learn? Are some brains just intrinsically math challenged, or does the fault lie with the way we teach mathematics to the young?
We'll take up these questions and get to more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
I am pleased to announce you can add up amounts. Put some bounce in your life and start counting now. Yes.
Counting is wonderful. Mathematics is the basis of counting, and it's even more wonderful. Math in the mind is our topic today. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Keith Devlin from Stanford University and NPR's The Math Guy.
Okay, let's grant that the human brain is, in some sense, built for mathematics. That leads to a two-part question. Why is explicit mathematical competence so hard to acquire? Something we've been investigating. We'll continue that. Second, is there anything we can do as a practical matter to make it easier to acquire?
Okay, well, I'll come back to my distinction between the abstracted mathematics, which is the mathematics that comes out of the world and is really reasoning about the world. And that's the stuff that everyone needs in spades to live, particularly in today. Actually, we've always needed in our evolutionary history, but with different purposes. You really need that stuff. Then there's the symbolic stuff. I don't know of any way to learn symbolic mathematics other than practice, practice, practice. I don't believe there's another way to do it besides practice, practice, practice. But we have evolved a symbolic brain, a brain that is really good at learning symbolic patterns. We can learn nonsense things. We can learn Jabberwocky. We can remember ditties and advertising slogans and jingles and so forth. The brain is very good at dealing with these kind of repetitive patterns. And if we practice them in the realm of mathematics, we can get to be good at mathematics. But practice is only going to work if people want to do it. The other side is the natural mathematics that's in the everyday world. The experiments, the studies I mentioned earlier and that Ken responded to, have shown that everyone placed in an environment can pick that up pretty darn quickly, just the way they pick up language by hearing it spoken all around
them. So isn't there some way to leverage that fact in our schools and make, you know, I mean, well, isn't there some way to
leverage
that?
You know, it depends what you want to teach. If you simply want to develop people so that they're really good at everyday mental mathematics in the world, yes, by golly, we do now have the way to do it, but we haven't started doing it
that
way.
But when you say everyday mental mathematics in the world, if we were to develop people to have explicit symbolic competence at that, how far into mathematics would that take them? I mean, how sophisticated is everyday mental mathematics?
What we're really talking about now is the transfer problem, where you learn something in one context and you try to apply it in a different way. It could well be that I think we now do have the methods for making people mathematically competent in the sense of everyday math, non-symbolic, not paper and pencil mathematics. Whether making them competent in that makes it easier for them to learn symbolic mathematics, I doubt it very much, although it may well motivate them. And motivation, I think, is 99% of the game in learning symbolic mathematics.
Well, let me get a little clearer about this division, though. So kids in school, they learn addition, then subtraction, then multiplication, then division, then long division, fractions comes in there. Is this all on the practical side? I mean, I do long division with paper and pencil. Is that on the symbolic side? Where does the break come?
There, well, I mean, remember I said at the beginning that, like all lines, it's a fuzzy line. You're beginning to get on that line now because... But a lot of that is the hangover from the fact that long division has actually been taught to us symbolically. It was never taught to us in the world. In fact, most kids learn to add and subtract, not in the classroom, but by living in the world around them.
This is Philosophy Talk. We're discussing math in the mind with the math guy, Keith Devlin, and we'd like our listeners to join in this conversation. We'd especially like some successful or maybe unsuccessful two math educators to share your experience with us. And if you've had the experience of not knowing math and then having a breakthrough in your understanding, share that experience with us too. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Hunter in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Hunter.
Thanks, guys.
What's your comment or question?
I don't think you could have set my question up any better.
Okay.
It was right along the lines of what you're talking about. It's more of a story, but I was it was when we was doing arithmetic as in a first or second grader, and the teacher handed us a big sheet of subtraction problems to do that were quite overwhelming. And I did the first five or so, and 11 minus 7, you know, I got 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Okay, 4 is the answer. And after about 10 of those, something clicked in my head. Little school kid, something clicked. I was like, wait a minute, I'm just looking for the gap between the two. I don't have to count down. And I looked back at the five that had taken me about 5 minutes to do, and I did them each in about 2 seconds with that concept. And I ran up to the teacher, and it felt like quite an epiphany. And the teacher, unfortunately, was one of those athletic instructors who gets stuck with a couple of academic classes with kids. And I tried to explain to him what I you know, I'm just looking for the relationship between them and the gap between them, and it's not really just counting down the numbers or the symbols, and he didn't really get it and had me go back to my chair. But
wow.
Ever since then, I still remember that moment now when I just sort of saw the patterns and saw the relationships, and it wasn't just counting down numbers on a page.
Hunter, that's a cool thing. Keith, you got any reaction to that? Thanks a lot, Hunter.
Boy, yeah, that's what Hunter's talking about is what in the business is called discovery learning, which is where you present students with a situation where by just playing with it, exploring it, they'll eventually intuit what's going on and they'll discover it, because this is the abstracted mathematics. That process of abstraction has to be done by each individual person learning mathematics. It's no good someone telling you it. All that will do is set the parameters within which you can make that leap.
But see, that shows, Hunter, and your reaction to it says there must be a way to improve mathematical education by leveraging this, because what happened to Hunter? The teacher didn't get it. I know a story, like a good friend of mine who is now a prominent philosopher of physics. When he was in the second or third grade, the story of Goldilocks and the three bears, my porridge is too hot, my porridge is too cold, and the middle one's my porridge is just right. He could not make any sense of that. And he asked the teacher, why is it work like that? Shouldn't it be, you know, shouldn't the smallest one, you know? And the teacher said, it's just a story, John.
Yeah, you know, right? As that Receive study showed, if we could make every single child could be put in charge of a street stall for 3 months, everybody would be extremely fluent at basic mathematics, the basic addition, multiplication and subtraction. That's impractical, even though it works extremely well. But we do now have a technology where we can make everybody in a class be the market holder in a stall. We just go into something like Second Life. We have virtual worlds which we can create. And that is the future of mathematics education for basic math.
Let's get a couple of more callers in here. David in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, David. What's your comment or question?
Hi, first of all, I'm really enjoying the show. And I recall back in the elementary school when I felt like most of us were kind of doled off to being either mathematically inclined or we were, you know, inclined towards being a writer. And I sort of remember early on that I had a difficulty with mathematics, and I bought into the idea pretty early that I just wasn't mathematically oriented, and that I used a different region of my brain more than the other one, and that was the reason. And I kind of kept enforcing that truth over my whole life. And so first off, I was wondering if that's really fact or fiction, the idea that some people are just inherently more mathematically inclined than others. I kind of don't believe it, but I'm curious.
Okay, thanks for the question, David. Keith, that'll be your last.
If by mathematically inclined you mean liking it or wanting to do it, sure. But if you're by mathematically inclined you mean having the capacity to do it, no, I think we all have the capacity to do it. Not to the same degree of success, but, you know, everyone that's born with a pair of working legs can walk and can jog, and if they train enough, they can run a marathon. Will they all win the Olympics in the marathon? No, but everyone can finish it if they want to put their minds to it. It's the same with mathematics. It's done by the brain. The brain is an organ. If you want to push it to a certain degree of excellency, you will, but you'll have your built-in limitations.
On that optimistic note, Keith, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Okay, it's been my pleasure, guys. I've enjoyed it.
Our guest has been Keith Devlin. He's professor of mathematics and a senior researcher at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. He's author of The Math Instinct, Why You're a Math Genius, along with Lobsters, Birds, Cats, and Dogs. He's also the math guy on NPR's Weekend Edition. So, John, briefly, what did you learn today?
Well, one thing I didn't learn is that I could run a marathon. I don't believe that. I think I could probably more likely to be able to learn higher math than run a marathon. But aside from that, as usual, Keith Devlin, who I've known for a long time, maybe 20 years or so now, proved he's just an incredible, incredibly good at relating difficult mathematical concepts and mathematical research and things like that to the average person like me. It was a joy to have him on the show.
Yeah, and it was great. I learned a lot. I was provoked a lot. My thoughts were provoked because I'm really, you know, I've got a 10-year-old son who struggles with mathematics, but is a very, at natural mathematics, is very adept, very analytical, very sharp, and you get it in school and he just struggles and struggles and struggles, and I think there just must be a way to leverage the natural human ability to navigate the world and get around in the world into a better educational method. There just must be a way, because our current educational methods, to tell you the truth, I think they, well, not to put a point on it, suck. Well, what do you think about that? So, John, this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog, and Keith Devlin has promised to weigh in.
You know, you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well now, and there is a small charge. We want you to know that that goes to making more Philosophy Talk programs. We don't just use it to buy makeup for me and a new Maserati for Ken. So things we really need, but we don't use it for that, just to make new Philosophy Talk shows.
Joining us now on Philosophy Talk are KLW's Diane Keough and our good friend and collaborator and compatriot Meryl Kessler, a.k.a. Ian Cho. So welcome, guys.
Hi. Good to see you in the studio. I usually...
So we're not here to just chat amongst ourselves, though.
No.
Why are we here, Diane?
We're here to talk to the people about coming to the event on December 3rd and to raise, it's a fundraiser for KALW. It's a continuation of what we're going to do today. But we're also here to listen to the one-minute philosopher because he has made something very special for us today.
Oh, you have?
I have.
Ian Cho's the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Cho's pledge is more than a four-posh. It's an activity that will make you feel good about yourself and make KALW feel like I can bring you the fine programs you have come to expect. Your great expectations can only be met if you, and this means you, Mr. or Ms. Non-Pledger, pick up the phone, punch in the number, and cough up the dough. Your conscience will be eased. KLW will stay on the air, all beginning with this magic number, 1-800-525-9917. Call now. I gotta go.
There you go. Hey, we don't usually get to see you do that live.
That's terrific.
Except you can see him do it live when we go on the road. We take the show on the road.
That's
we just
right.
came back from Azalea, California. And we haven't been on the road in San Francisco. But December 3rd, we're going to change that. We're going to do a live taping of the show at Biscuits and Blues on December 3rd in the evening. And you're invited. And you can see the whole crew. Ian, a.k.a. Murrow,
will be there.
John will be there. I'll be there. Zoe Corneli, who's the loveliest member of our staff, will be there. So we'll all be there. And come check it out. And what do they have to do to...
In order to do that, they have to call 1-800-525-9917, or they can go on the web at KALW.org and pledge $100 and ask for a ticket for the wonderful event on December 3rd with David Harrington of the Kronos Quartet, who is going to be your special guest, and then we're going to have a surprise musical interlude afterwards. It's going to be fun.
And we're
going
to put a question to David. John, why does music matter? And I assume he's going to answer it, right?
Oh, I think he will. Why does music matter, and why does matter music? That's the question, too, I mean, because everything that makes music is matter. I want to just say a word to you folks out there that maybe aren't in San Francisco or listening on the Internet or on one of our other stations. Maybe you don't have $100 even if you're here. Every contribution counts. And you students out there, if you can send us $10 or $20, you'll help keep us on the air. This program, I mean, you might think, gosh, those guys are so good, they must get money hand over fist to do Philosophy Talk. Turns out it's not true. It's all dependent on KALW, the little station that could, 1-800-525-9917, or if you're listening on the Internet, go to the KALW website and pledge on the Internet.
1-800-525-9917. Some of you remember Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and they have the great song, Chicago. Now, there's a line in there, don't ask Jack to help you because he'll turn the other ear, right? And there's another line, no one else can take your part. And that's true about donating to KLW and public radio in general. I've learned this only recently. Only 1 in 9 listeners donate. The rest of you are free
beats.
Riders.
Dead beats.
Well, that's a pejorative term.
Not
this
dead.
Is a technical term. Free riders. Now, here's a problem. You don't know who's going to free ride, right? You don't know if the guy next to you is going to do his part or not. Or do her part or not. So if you want to keep this on, you have to do your part. You can't really depend on the other guy. You can't ask Jack to help you because he'll turn the other ear. No one else can take your part. So get off your duff. Call 1-800-525-9917. Diane wouldn't like me saying that. She's looking at me like, oh, shame on you. But it's true. Yeah. Get
and
off
if
your
you
duff.
You don't have a duff, get one and then get off.
You know, there's some new research that we've conducted at my lab that shows that the 1 out of 9 persons who does contribute typically is better looking and more intelligent than the other 8.
There you go.
So
if you want
think
to become,
about that.
Get better looking and maybe taller or thinner.
And be a new person.
And go to heaven.
Brand new person.
Right, right. But you guys are committing a logical fallacy, something like, post hoc ergo proter hoc.
1-800-525-9917. Let's keep the volunteers busy the way we've been busy here in the studio this morning. Pick up the phone and call 1-800-525-9917 and ask for a ticket for that wonderful evening that's coming up.
$100
in December.
Per ticket, right?
$100 per ticket. We decided not to keep you up there in the stratosphere. We're putting you down on ground with the rest of us. $100 for that, and if you can't afford that, we do have the book for $60 that we are going to have autographed by Keith. That would be lovely. And if you can't afford that, as John said, whatever you can afford is what we will appreciate very much.
And there's a lot of wonderful shows on KELW, and whenever you pledge, it's just fine. But if you are particularly a Philosophy Talk fan, keep in mind that program directors here and elsewhere do keep track of how popular a program is in terms of how many pledges come in. So this is the time for you Philosophy Talk fans to make your pledge and help us be a reputation as a program that really appeals to the 1 out of 9 that contributes.
This is called voting with your pledge, right? You want to keep Philosophy Talk on the air, vote with your pledge.
Make it a cash cow.
That's cash cow. We've got some crude metaphors, mixed metaphors right here. That's you get when you get four people in the same room.
Only three of you are using those weird metaphors. Like that.
No, but 1-800-525-9917. We're all, though, on the same boat. We're appealing to you to help keep this ship afloat.
1-800-525-9917. The evening, I'm looking forward to the evening very much. December 3rd at Biscuits and Blues, downtown San Francisco. And David Harrington is going to be the guest, and you're going to be asking him why music matters. Do you think he's going to have several answers or just one?
He's going to have some surprise guests to illustrate music mattering. And I got to tell you, our live events are so cool. They're so much fun. They're happenings, and we're going to make this one a special happening for you at a special place. So 1-800-525-9917, $100
per ticket. $100 per ticket. And the other thing is you're going to get to meet everybody face-to-face. They don't sit behind a great big screen. They come right out and talk to you. So if you've ever wanted to talk to John or to Ken or to Merle, you're going to get a chance to do it that night on December 3rd.
And Zoe will be there,
And I bet Ben Manila will be there.
Ben Manila will be there.
Everybody's going to be there. So you can talk to everybody you want to talk to. 1-800-525-9917. If you don't call that number, you can't get the ticket. And if you don't get the ticket, you can't come and meet everybody.
And remember, for $60, you can get a copy of Keith Devlin's book on math and the mind. $60, that's not much. That's, one triple latte with brandy at Starbucks for a week.
You're pretty good at natural mathematics.
Yeah, So keep it coming in. 1-800-525-9917.
1-800-525-9917.
The Kronos Quartet is very well known all over the country, in fact, all over the world. And I think we're very, very pleased to be able to have David Harrington on the show with you that night. I think it's going to be an incredible evening.
So you'll be able to meet face-to-face and hobnob, not just with the Philosophy Talk crew, but with David Harrington of the Kronos Quartet and some unknown mystery surprise musical guest. I'm really intrigued by this.
And it's not Ken with his trumpet.
That would be kind of another fun evening.
That would be the trombone.
Maybe I'll bring my banjo.
There you go. Merle on the banjo.
1-800-525-9917. That's the number to call. Keep those folks in the phone room busy this hour. We require you to require us to bring you the programming. So if you like the programming, then now is the way to show it. Now is the time.
Keep them busy right now so that I can run to the kitchen and grab one of their bagels.
Oh, yes. Get a bagel, by all means.
1-800-525-9917.